Let's bring in our friend Mark Schofield, the Locked On Patriots podcast, Inside the Pylon, of course, Score NFL, and much, much more. Mark, happy playoffs. How are you?
Gentlemen, happy playoffs to you. It's always great to be talking about these matchups. And wildcard weekend is always a little bit of fun, especially that late game on Saturday. That tends to be kind of a wild one. So it should be a good weekend of football.
All right. You know, before we get to what's happening this week, and I do want to get your thoughts on that matchup between the Hawks and the Cowboys, especially with the quarterbacks, what was the best throw you did see in week 17 of the NFL season?
I'm actually going to go off script. I'm calling an audible here at the line of scrimmage. The best throw I saw last week was at the college level, and it was Kyler Murray. Mm. And I know that Oklahoma lost, and I get that. And I know that it might have been his final football game, and I understand that. But that throw he made on that deep touchdown when he was basically climbing towards the line of scrimmage and basically threw it with neither of his feet off the ground, like the baseball player that he is, that was the best throw I saw all week. And you could point to, of course, the regional names, you know, whether it's, you know, Patrick Mahomes, Tom Brady had a couple of nice throws in that win over the Jets. But that throw by Kyler Murray, that shows you right there why he's such an exciting athlete to watch and why there are a lot of teams, NFL teams, that is, that are hoping that he decides to maybe hold off on baseball for a bit and give football a shot.
Now, before we move, I did want to ask you one thing, because every single year, we always get it's either a great quarterback draft or a terrible quarterback draft, and typically, we always get at least one good quarterback in every single draft. What do you make of people saying you can't find a franchise quarterback in the 2019 draft?
I mean, I think that's an oversimplification of it. I'm sitting here right now, and I'm watching Will Grier against Kansas, and yes, you know, he's going to need some work, for example. But he's a guy that if you find him in the right fit, you get him in the right scheme, he can become an NFL quarterback and a good one. And I think that's the kind of task in front of, you know, offensive coordinators, head coaches, general managers in this draft class. Last year's quarterback class was easy. You had five guys go in the first round. You know, you were pretty sure that if you were drafting a guy in the first round, you're going to get somebody, whether it's a Sam Darnold, a Josh Allen, a Josh Rosen, you know, Baker Mayfield, Lamar Jackson, that was probably going to become your starter at some point early in their career. This draft, it's a bit different. We'll wait it on Dwayne Haskins. I think if he comes out, he will be the first quarterback off the board. If he doesn't, if he somehow decides to stay, then you're looking at Drew Locke, you're looking at Daniel Jones, Will Grier as perhaps, you know, late first round type guys, but they can still become good quarterbacks in the right system. And what might be interesting in this draft is maybe teams sort of wait, maybe teams sort of draft these guys late first round, early second, and so there isn't that pressure to get them on the field the right way immediately, which is better for their development. So I think you could still find franchise quarterbacks in this draft. It's just going to be more incumbent on the teams that draft these guys to handle their development the right way, because they're going to need some time, they're going to need some refinement, but there are still good quarterbacks to be found.
A lot more draft talk to come over the next few weeks leading to the NFL draft, of course. But Mark, we are focusing on Saturday's matchups, and the one game we were talking about before you joined us here just a few minutes ago, Seattle against Dallas. They met in week three. It was a win there for Seattle. But my first question to you is, since that week three game, how far has Dak Prescott come, especially now with the addition of Amari Cooper to that receiving line and the fact that he has more weapons to be playing with?
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's sort of, you know, the two big changes from that week three game, obviously the lack of Earl Thomas on one side and the addition of Amari Cooper. Because with Cooper, you've added a player that can minimize Prescott's weaknesses and deficiencies as a quarterback. That being, sometimes his ball placement is off. Cooper's a receiver that can get better separation. So he's given Dak Prescott sort of that security blanket as a receiving target that Prescott can be a little bit off target, but it doesn't matter because the separation is there. You look at the routes that Cooper has run since he's come over to Dallas, the separation that he's getting on a consistent basis. That has taken so much pressure off of Dak Prescott as a quarterback that he's now functioning better as a quarterback, obviously, since that trade. You know, the main thing that I'm going to be watching in this game is, can they protect Prescott? You look at the Cowboys this year. When they give up five sacks or more, and yes, that's a big number, but still, they give up five sacks or more in a game, they lost three out of four of those contests, including that game back in week three. Mm. You know, Tyron Smith, he struggles at times with outside speed, pass rushing moves. Frank Clark got him on a sack in that week three game on one such move. If Seattle can consistently get after Prescott, his numbers under pressure, while he's thrown nine touchdowns and two interceptions when pressured, that's pretty good. But that quarterback rating does dip dramatically from what he does when he's not facing pressure. And so that's going to be a key, I think, to this game.
And how do you think Dallas needs to approach this game if they want to win here? Because obviously, as you mentioned, Earl Thomas not in the lineup anymore, but the way Russell Wilson has played this season, he's been lights out, a career-high 35 touchdowns for him this regular season.
I mean, I think a key for Dallas is to try to establish a bit of the run game. You want to sort of get Ezekiel Elliott involved. You want to sort of take the pressure off Dak Prescott a bit. I think what's going to be interesting to watch is what kind of personnel packages are they going to use? Are they going to sort of go heavy at times and try to like throw out of heavier formations? Are they going to go light box and try to, free up things for Ezekiel Elliott inside? And if it were me, that's kind of the approach that I would take. I would take a lot more of 11 personnel formations, try to get Seattle into more nickel and dime packages that will free up the inside, get you some lighter boxes to run Ezekiel Elliott against, and then you can start working off that play action game. I think that's probably the recipe for Dallas to go into Seattle and pull off a win.
Well, there's another game in Texas. It's the Texans hosting the Colts. It's an early game on Saturday. How do the quarterbacks match up in this one? Deshaun Watson versus Andrew Luck.
Yeah, that's a fascinating game to watch for me. And I think, when the Texans have the football, that passing game, that, their aerial attack basically runs through DeAndre Hopkins. He saw the fifth most targets of any NFL wide receiver this year, 169, I believe, maybe it was 163, somewhere around there. But in terms of the target share, he saw 32% of their passing attempts this year, which is most for any wide receiver. Especially now, with Will Fuller being out, they're going to run things through them. What they do schematically is rather simplify. They do a lot of flood concepts, three receivers to one side of the field, the Yankee concept with a deep post route and a dig route underneath it. They like to do stuff like that. They're going to try to get, Deshaun Watson comfortable. They can try to move him around a little bit in the pocket. Whereas with the Colts, they do a lot of different things and they do them all well. The Colts attempt a bunch of their throws within 5 yards of the line of scrimmage, but they've still been able to have a vertical element to their passing game. They like to throw out of bigger personnel packages, two tight ends, three tight ends, sometimes two tight ends and an extra offensive lineman, but then they'll set up a defense with that base defense look on the field, and then they'll attack you downfield in the passing game. Plus the emergence of T.Y. Hilton. Emergence is probably the wrong way to put it, but the growth of him and Luck this year in the downfield passing game as well. And so you're going to see more variety from Andrew Luck and the Colts offense in the passing game. But these are two offenses that can do things good and effective in the passing game. They just do it in different ways.
Well, and speaking of two offenses that do things in different ways, Chargers versus Ravens. I mean, Lamar Jackson, the running game with Ravens versus the aerial assault of the LA Chargers. How do these quarterbacks match up, Rivers versus Lamar Jackson?
Right, and it's two quarterbacks, obviously, at different ends of their playing careers and on different ends of their spectrum. Mm-hmm. And Baltimore, we've seen what they've wanted to do this year since installing Lamar Jackson as their quarterback. It's basically, we're going to work on the run game. We're going to do a lot of zone read type stuff. We're going to give Lamar Jackson some chances to be effective with his legs. But when you look back at that game a couple of weeks ago that Baltimore did win, the Chargers were pretty effective at stopping Lamar Jackson as a ball carrier. He had, I think, 13 carries for 39 yards. And on, I think, 8 or 9 of his rushing attempts, he was held to 3 yards or less. They did something called the scrape exchange where, on that zone read play, you're leaving that defensive end unblocked and you're trying to block him with the action of the play, whether the quarterback hands it off or not. You're kind of reading him and working off of that. The Chargers basically used that sort of scrape exchange where they tell the defensive end, crash down inside no matter what. We're going to have the linebacker float to the edge. We're going to make the quarterback's decision for him. So when he sees you crash down, he's going to pull it and try to run to the edge, and then we get the linebacker flowing down. They did that a couple of times and it worked. So I watched for that a ton. As for Rivers, obviously a different quarterback. He's not going to be running the football too much. He's going to be handing in there against the blitz. Very effective this year against pressure. One of the best quarterback ratings in the league when pressured this year. And he loves to sort of hand in there, make a throw when he's getting hit. Gives his receivers time to work open downfield. So a huge contrast in styles, but going to be a very fun game to watch for that reason.
Melvin Gordon should be healthy. They're still waiting to see if Hunter Henry can suit up there for the Chargers. So that should be maybe some healthy bodies to help out Philip Rivers there for the Chargers. Now, that brings us to the final wildcard matchup here, Mark, and that's Eagles and Bears. What do you like in this situation? Last year's MVP and Nick Foles with a flawed Eagles team, or first time for Mitch Trubisky to be playing in the postseason with the Chicago Bears team that has such a strong defense?
Yeah, this is a tough game to call because I could see it going in one of either directions. And sometimes when you see, you know, look back at last year in the Rams, they sort of made that kind of jump with Jared Goff having the development under Sean McVay. They play better. The offense seems to be, you know, putting up points in bunches, doing some cool things schematically so they get into the playoffs. But then they lose to a team that had some playoff experience in them, the Atlanta Falcons. And you could see a scenario like that playing out with the Bears where they have that sort of leap. Trubisky gets, you know, a little bit better in his second year under an offensive-minded head coach. And you think, you know, look, they're doing what they can do on both sides of the football, but then they're not, you know, ready for the playoff-type atmosphere. Obviously, the Philadelphia Eagles have done that, you know, with the year they had last year. They basically played three straight playoff games to get themselves even into the dance. And so they're obviously more tested and experienced in this kind of environment. So you can see Philadelphia going in and pulling off this victory. But I think when you look at how Chicago has played this year, you look at what they've done defensively, they have the talent both up front and in the secondary to force some mistakes from Nick Foles. You look at some of the interceptions he's thrown the past couple of weeks. It's when he sees a combination of pressure and or a different look in the secondary that he's not expecting. When he sees that, sometimes he makes mistakes, sometimes he forces throws, sometimes he misses throws badly. You look at the interception he threw against Washington, collapse in pocket, it was just an airmail type throw. I think the Bears are going to force one or two big mistakes from Nick Foles. They'll give Trubisky in that offense a couple of short fields to work with, and that's going to be the difference in this game.
How interested are you to see this Bears offense because of how Matt Nagy has been so creative this season in scheming and trying to get the best out of Trubisky and his receiving group?
I mean, I've been fascinated watching how Nagy has used and, you know, developed and cultivated the quarterback inside Mitchell Trubisky this year. He's done some great things with him from a schematic standpoint. He's been able to recognize when he needs to calm his quarterback down and get him into the flow of the game. And what I mean by that is there are times, and Trubisky will admit this himself, whether it's at the start of the game or the start of the second half, he's a little bit too amped up. He will call designed runs for his quarterback to sort of get him into the flow of the game. There are times where he will go pure run-pass option stuff to get him some simplified reads. There are times when Trubisky will miss a throw in a route concept. He'll come back to it later in the game to basically tell his quarterback, look, I still believe in you. I know you can hit this throw. You'll go out there and do it. And they've done that a couple of times this year with great results. And so how Nagy has sort of developed his young quarterback has been great to watch this year. And I expect a big leap for Trubisky in year three. But in year two here, I think this Bears team has enough talent on both sides of the ball to make a run deep into these playoffs.
You've talked about this before, Mark. When it comes to Mitch Trubisky's footwork, what are you seeing development-wise in that aspect?
It's still a work in progress. And, you know, I've written this, I've said this a bunch of times. If I were Matt Nagy, whenever their season ends and you have that sort of year-end exit meeting with your quarterback, I give him one assignment and one assignment only. You have to fix that left foot. You know, when we talk about right-handed quarterbacks, the usual expression is step towards the target, but you sort of want to step a little bit to the left of the target line to allow that right hip to come through. He will step in the bucket. He will step at a 90-degree angle away from his target a lot of the time, and that will lead to some missed throws. You look at, for example, an interception he threw against the Rams. He had that crossing route, that bending vertical route from right to left. He steps in the bucket wildly. He overthrows it, and it gets intercepted. Now, a couple of weeks later, he had a similar route into the left corner of the end zone. The footwork is better. The throw was better, and it resulted in a touchdown. So he's working on it. But if I were Matt Nagy, no matter how their season ends, when it ends, even if he throws 10 interceptions in their final game, I'm sitting him down. I'm saying, look, fix that left foot, and that's going to go a long way to you become the quarterback you can be.
Now, we know about the playoff teams, and we're talking about these quarterbacks on these teams that are trying to get to divisional round next week. But what about the teams that are looking for a new head coach? A quarter of the league is looking for a new head coach, and you have a number of these teams that have a young quarterback, let's say the Cleveland Browns, and they have to make a decision. Do they bring Freddie Kitchens, the OC, back? Do they keep Greg Williams as a head coach, as a defensive guy? Do they hire somebody else? If you have a young quarterback, and you know, or you believe he's a franchise QB, what type of coach do you pair him with, and how important is it to make sure that the head coach is the key? Because we spend so many times talking about, hey, you can get a defensive head coach, but make sure you get a good OC that can work with the quarterback. But if you get a good OC that has success with the quarterback, he's going to get a head coaching job. So how do you go about pairing your young quarterback with the right coach?
I mean, it's vital. It's vital because there is no bigger competitive advantage right now in the NFL than a starting quarterback on his rookie deal. You look at the 12 playoff teams right now, seven of them, and that's if you count the Eagles with Carson Wentz, are in that situation. And then they've seen the Seattle Seahawks, they won a Super Bowl using that model. And so when you have that rookie quarterback, if you can get the most out of him, it gives you the ability to go out and sign free agents, make trades, and address your team in other areas and get yourselves competitive. But you have to have the right offensive coaching staff or head coach around that quarterback to get the most out of him. That's why if I'm John Dorsey, I look at how Baker Mayfield has played since the Hugh Jackson firing, and I think I'm keeping Freddie Kitchens in place, whether we have to leave him as OC and leave Greg Williams as head coach, or we just promote Freddie Kitchens to the head coaching spot, even though it might be early for that because of the success they've had, because you need to get the most out of your rookie quarterback during that stretch. That's why I think the Arizona job is kind of attractive, even though that team looked bad, almost woeful at times on offense, because you've got Josh Rosen, you've got talent on the defensive side of the ball, you've got Johnson, you've got Fitzgerald, you've got Christian Kirk, you've got some weapons, you can be competitive pretty quickly. Same thing with the Jets. Young quarterback, rookie deal, you can be competitive. And so for these organizations that are in that situation, you have to maximize this window. So you have to get the best offensive mind you can to work with that young quarterback. And if they end up moving on because they get a head coaching gig as a result, you're still going to be an attractive option for other like-minded offensive coaches that maybe want to become head coaches because of the situation your organization is in.
Now, in terms of keeping changing the OC, I mean, we saw this with the Atlanta Falcons, for instance. We saw Kyle Shanahan have great success with the Falcons, Matt Ryan, and then Sarkisian last year, it was a bit up and down. But then this year, it seemed like Sarkisian had got the same level of productivity from both Julio Jones and Matt Ryan as Kyle Shanahan did 2 years ago, but he got fired from it. What do you make of that situation in Atlanta, and what does that tell us? What lesson is to be learned from that situation, given that they have a defensive head coach in Dan Quinn?
Yeah, I mean, I think the lesson sort of to be learned there, and you know, we've seen this play out in other organizations. We saw, for example, in Minnesota with Mike Zimmer, defensive-minded head coach, and John DeFilippo, is that there has to be an agreement between, you know, the defensive-minded head coach and the offensive coordinator that, look, you know, this is how we're going to do things offensively. And I know you're a defensive-minded guy and you might want to run the ball, establish the run, things like that. You look at the talent that Atlanta had. The talent was mostly in the passing game with Matt Ryan, with Julio Jones, with the addition of Calvin Ridley, you know, with Austin Hooper, and pretty nice tight end piece that they have, Mohamed Sanu. We're going to throw the ball. This is a throwing league now. And you might come from a background that says you've got to establish the run and stop the run to win football games. That's a, you know, 1995 mindset. That's not a 2018 mindset. We're going to throw the ball. There might be some mistakes, but this is how we have to do things in this league. This is how teams are built now. They're built around the passing game. The money in Atlanta was built around the passing game. So that's what we have to do to win games. And if you don't like it, we've got a bigger problem than, you know, the lack of production in the offense. And so there has to be this understanding between these defensive-minded head coach types like the Zimmers and the Quinns of the world that this is a passing league, and defensive-minded head coaches should probably figure that out given what they're trying to scheme against each and every week.
Sportsnet 650.